Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Today, as Supreme Court Chief Justice nominee John Roberts responds to questions about civil rights.
You have not accurately represented my position.
These are your words.
Now let him finish his answer.
Senator, with
that was
respect,
quite a long
you have
question.
Selected.
Wait a minute. Senator Kennedy just propounded a very, very...
The exchanges have been largely tempered. Roberts was also pressed on whether he would uphold Roe versus Wade, which legalized abortion. Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston is on the line. And Lyle, so far Judge Roberts is declining to comment on particular cases. How do you think he's doing?
The nominee is being very careful in selecting the questions to which he is going to give definitive responses. I thought he was actually a little more forthcoming in his exchanges with Senator Spector, because he did indicate that when the issue of abortion rights arises again, one would not immediately address the question of whether Roe was wrong, whether the 1973 original decision was wrong, but one would start with the precedent in 1992, which reaffirmed parts of Roe and the basic core of the constitutional rights. So I think what he has not made a commitment that he would support Casey, but I think he has indicated to the Senate, at least his present inclination is, that he would be somewhat reluctant to reach out for a quick overruling of Roe, and might feel quite bound by the 1992 precedent, which, of course, leaves Roe largely intact.
And that was that 1992 case was Casey versus Planned Parenthood, a case in which a woman was allowed to have an abortion without her husband knowing.
Yes, and the court upheld, interestingly, in that case, most of the provisions of the Pennsylvania abortion control law, but struck down one. But the most important facet of the case is that, as a general proposition, the court reaffirmed the core holding of the 1973 decision, which is that the woman does have this right. The court modified the test that it would use to judge future abortion restrictions, relaxed that a good deal. And I think John Roberts' comments today indicate, at least as a preliminary kind of matter, that Roe and Casey are probably pretty safe in his hands.
Well, in fact, the phrase stare decisis has been thrown around a lot today. What does that mean?
Well, stare decisis is a really age-old judicial principle which says it's better to have the law settled than perhaps sometimes it's better even than to have it settled right, because people have interests, they have rights that are dependent upon knowing what the law is, and so judges should, as a general matter, leave existing precedents undisturbed.
And did John Roberts say he agreed with that thinking?
Well, I think he clearly does, and as a matter of fact, he regularly makes the argument, and he's been doing so again today, that in his view of the supposed humility that a judge should respect indicates a strong reliance upon precedent, a strong respect for precedent. So I think what he's trying to tell the senators is, don't expect me to be like Justice Thomas on the present court and argue regularly that even the most fundamental precedent should be reconsidered.
Well, there were some heated moments this morning between Massachusetts Democrat Ted Kennedy and Judge John Roberts, as we heard, about the Voting Rights Act of 1982 and other civil rights cases. This because of things that Roberts had written in papers when he served in the Reagan and other administrations. How did Roberts respond?
Well, Roberts really responded in two ways. One, he is being very precise in describing exactly what his intentions were and what his words and their meaning were at the time he wrote them. But he also is being fairly careful in indicating that these are frozen in that time and that they represent largely the views that a government lawyer was making to sustain government positions. His exchanges with Kennedy, I think, became a little bit heated because Kennedy has a really aggressive style with a witness whose views he doesn't particularly like, and he over-talks the witness testimony, and he won't let the witness answer his questions. And in fact, this is the first testy moment in these hearings when the chairman, Arlen Specter, had to intervene to tell Kennedy to let the witness complete his answers. But I don't think that there's any real substantive content to this exchange that led to these momentary sparks. I think what it's all about is that Senator Kennedy, like most of the Democrats, is going to make a great deal out of these old memos in order to try to show that that Roberts perhaps is a risk for them as a member of the Supreme Court.
And as Robert said several times this morning, as a lawyer, you do what your client wants you to do. Lyle Denniston is a Supreme Court reporter. He writes SCOTUS blog online. Lyle will be coming back to you during the course of the hearings. Thank you.
Excellent, Robin.
Well, now to the Gulf, where there are signs of hope in New Orleans. The airport, where so many of the city's residents received medical care in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, is scheduled to receive its first commercial flight today, and the port is expecting its first cargo, a ship carrying up to 500 containers of coffee and wood products from Argentina, Brazil, and Mexico. But there is grim reality as well. The city's coroner is planning to conduct autopsies on the more than 40 bodies recovered Sunday from Memorial Medical Center. And FEMA's new chief is pledging housing for the thousands of evacuees. This after much criticized FEMA leader Michael Brown announced his resignation yesterday. We'll have more on changes in the organization in a moment. But first, FEMA officials asked last week that no pictures be taken of dead bodies as they're retrieved in New Orleans. Several news photographers objected. Vincent LaForêt is a photographer for the New York Times. He was in New Orleans during Katrina's wrath, and he produced some of the iconic images there. He joins us. And Vincent, your thoughts, first of all, on the FEMA request.
I mean, I obviously have pretty strong emotions about the story, and to me this is a pretty blatant attempt at censorship in the same way that the Bush administration did not want to have any photos of soldiers coming back from Iraq in caskets or in any form. No one wants the public to see the incredible death toll that has resulted from this, and I totally respect and understand the need to not photograph dead people whose family have not been notified, or for that purpose to photograph any dead person. Body bags tell the story just as well.
But Michael Chertoff, Homeland Security Chief, is saying that it's completely out of respect to the family that they're making this request. Doesn't he have a point that maybe, you know, you, Vincent LaForêt of the New York Times, would take a tasteful, respectful photograph, but that others might not?
I can't speak for the others. I just know that I personally would only take a respectful photograph, and knowing full well that we wouldn't publish it if it weren't respectful. At the same time, the reason that I think that the majority of the images that have come out of this have been so powerful from everybody was that we have not been managed. They haven't had the resources to micromanage the media. There have been no PR people around telling us where we couldn't and couldn't go.
And these aren't embeds.
Correct. Even though I was initially an embed, that's how I got into Louisiana. It was with FEMA. It was the first troop that drove down from Louisiana into New Orleans from Baton Rouge. But I quickly broke off when I saw how slowly they were moving.
I want to hold you up there. Slowly they were moving. What do you mean?
Well, they just took hours to make simple decisions, and there was a lot of sitting around initially, which at that point I would just chalked off to, you know, this being a very large organization and being, you know, kind of slowed down by bureaucracy. As time went on, I came to realize that this was a much larger problem. We dealt with some very simple problems initially, which were we couldn't get onto boats with FEMA because we'd obviously be taking a spot in the boat that could be used to rescue someone. That was a very well-made argument, and that's why we eventually broke off and did our own thing. But what has to be said was there was no attempt being made at the time to try and limit my access to this story. One of the more poignant images that I was able to make, for me at least, was the photograph of an older lady on a conveyor belt at the airport. I know full well that had a PR person been there was no way we'd have been allowed in there. She was just kind of dazed and staring out. And I saw her the following day. She was still there.
But I'm wondering, going back to, the FEMA concerns,
yeah.
Do you think that was appropriate? This is someone's mother.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is the question that gets asked of photographers like yourself. Did you feel any guilt about taking her picture?
I didn't feel any guilt about taking anyone's picture because when I could talk to people, I always introduced myself and had a conversation. And I had maybe 5 people out of the hundreds I photographed who initially objected and within 15 seconds changed their minds when I would explain to them that the situations they were in were appalling, the response was incredibly slow, that I was incredibly sorry this was going on, and is there a way, you know, would you mind if I made a photograph of you to show this circumstance? And before you knew it, you'd have 5 people in the background raising their hands saying, take my picture and take my name. Mm. People started to realize that what I was doing and what other photographers are doing is simply to tell their story and to show the conditions they're in. We're not causing those conditions. Mm. We're recording them. If you remember correctly, back then, New Orleans was not supposed to be a story. Everybody was running away towards Gulfport, Mississippi, where supposedly the greatest damage was. So we all felt, I mean, I felt as a journalist, that no one was paying attention to us down there and that no one knew how bad it was. My job is not to offend people or to disrespect people. It's just to try and tell their story in the hopes that people will, you know, realize what's really going on.
You know, it's so interesting. I'm thinking that I'm going to ask you, but she had so little dignity. And then I realized that's the question that we end up having to ask war photographers all the time about people in foreign countries who are photographed in misery. And this is here.
Well, to me, she was one of the more dignified people I saw because I saw quite a few naked people just out in the open and no one was helping cover them up. There were people who looked like they were on the verge of death. And you got to understand, the people that I was with from FEMA or the doctors that were there wanted me there. They were telling me, we're overwhelmed. They have 900 people coming in an hour, and there's a very small staff of us. We cannot handle this. There's just too much, too strong, too fast. We need help. So, you know, journalists become their voice.
I'm looking at one right now. It's the little girl who had the striped shirt on, and she's sitting with a volunteer. Yeah. Well, I didn't know it was a volunteer. She's sitting just holding on to a man as they cross the waters in a boat.
His name was Chad, and I jumped in the boat with him. I was fighting tears back the entire time, and so was he. And we never exchanged a word. We just knew how frail this young girl was, and she was completely and utterly afraid, but yet comforted in this complete stranger's arms. It was just very, very tough to take all this in. I and other journalists and people perhaps will have the misfortune of seeing disasters in their lifetimes, but they're generally quick and fast, and they tend to end. The problem with this one is the scale is so huge that I don't see people being back to normalcy anytime soon.
Vincent LaFerre of the New York Times. To see what he saw, some of his photographs, go to our website, here-now.org. And when we come back, who is the new leader of FEMA, and what happens now to the organization? Much more coming up here and now. Responsibility for any failures of the federal government in responding to Hurricane Katrina. This comes a day after Michael Brown resigned as head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Brown was widely criticized for his lack of emergency management experience and for the government's response to the storm. He said he stepped down for the good of the agency.
You know, it's never fun being the fall guy, and I'm not certain that I'm being made to be a fall guy, but if being the fall guy gets done everything I want to get done, fine.
David Paulison has been appointed acting director of FEMA. For more on the new appointment and the future of FEMA, we turn to Jane Bullock. She was FEMA's chief of staff in the Clinton administration and is now a risk management consultant. She joins us from her office in Washington, D.C. First of all, Jane, your thoughts on the new acting director?
I think that David Paulison has some excellent background in fire and rescue and the fire services, and I wish him the best of luck in the position, but putting Mr. Paulson in is not going to change the fundamental problem we have. The system is broken.
Well, let's look at some of his credentials first. Head of the National Fire Administration, a division of FEMA. In terms of experience, he helped lead the emergency response to Hurricane Andrew in 1992, which, by the way, was much criticized, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And he was part of the search and rescue team down there, and he was in the Miami-Dade fire chief. The response to Hurricane Andrew, as with any disaster response, is usually run by the emergency managers, and the fire services support them. Hurricane Andrew was a very bad response on the federal level, as well as not as good as it could have been on the state and local level. And I think you can compare this response to Hurricane Andrew.
Well,
the lack of pre-deployment in Katrina was the same problem in Hurricane Andrew.
How much does it mean to you and to people on the ground that David Paulison was also a past president of the International Association of Fire Chiefs and a certified paramedic?
Dave's a really good guy, and he's an excellent fireman, but emergency services and emergency management is a broader issue than fire and rescue. I think that the fire community is probably feeling very proud that one of their own is head of FEMA. I just think that the issue is, does he have the political clout, does he have the support of the president, and will there be structural changes made?
Well, now, that would mean what for you?
Well, that would mean that the agency would be taken out from under the Department of Homeland Security and become an independent agency as it was in the 90s. You know, we have a very good model of what worked in the 90s. I mean, during Hurricane Floyd, there were 2.6 million people evacuated. During the Northridge earthquake, the infrastructure was severely damaged, probably as badly damaged as what we see in New Orleans. So we had a model that worked, and it worked as an independent agency, directly reporting to the president with a high priority placed on it by the president.
Do you think it should be a cabinet position as it once was?
I absolutely do. In that position, the head of FEMA is on an equal par with the other secretaries of the federal agency that FEMA has to task to do what needs to be done in a disaster.
Well, now to more of today's news, Michael Brown has stepped down. What about the other people in charge of FEMA? Patrick Rode, Deputy Chief of Staff, as well as Acting Deputy Chief of Staff Brooks Altshuler. Neither of them have a significant emergency management experience. They both had previously worked for the White House's Office of National Advance Operations. They arrange President Bush's travel, tell him where to stand on appearances. Should there be more resignations?
Well, I think that's the prerogative of the president and Mr. Paulson and Secretary Chertoff. But I think we can see that when you look at the model in the 1990s, not only was the head of FEMA a state former state director of emergency management, but we had other state directors that were in critical positions in our agency, including Lacey Souter, who had been the state director for Tennessee, and Dale Shipley, who had been a state director for the state of Ohio. My advantage to the job as chief of staff was I was a 22-year veteran in the agency. I knew the operations of the agency inside and out.
So you think people should come up from within the agency?
I think a mix is what you need. I clearly think that the director of FEMA has to be a high-level political position because he is interacting in a political administration. I also think that the administration during the 1990s counted on a good support staff in terms of other emergency managers, but also it really worked very well with the career staff.
Well, let me ask you this. David Paulison was a registered Democrat in the last election, so at first blush it doesn't appear to be at all a partisan appointment. Are you saying that, in fact, the fact that he is not a Republican and not politically tied to the White House might make it more difficult for him to work with the White House?
No, Robin, I'm not exactly saying that. What I'm saying is Mr. Paulson is in an organizational structure that does not put him on a par with the secretaries in the cabinet or even the undersecretaries in the cabinet. He can't pick up the phone and get Secretary Rumsfeld on the phone and say, we need to pre-deploy some military assets during the next hurricane. I really think that it's a structural problem.
You also mentioned the state directors of FEMA. What kind of a report card would you give the state directors in this current crisis, and what can be done to improve it on a state level?
I think that's a very good question, Robin. One of the issues that we've been raising is the fact that when FEMA went into the Department of Homeland Security, most of the focus, 75% or more of the focus, had to go on terrorism planning. So the state directors of emergency management are focusing on terrorism planning instead of focusing on the risks that they are more likely to face. And as a result, at the state level and the local level, we don't have that level of preparedness that we had before. We also don't have the level of partnership. When James Lee Witt was director of FEMA, he knew every single one of those state directors. He knew many, many local emergency managers. He also knew the governors. He would talk to the governors before a disaster and say, we're going to be there to help you. You have a direct line to me, and I am the person accountable for this disaster. And that system, those relationships, are broken. You know, the success of the 90 was building a model that worked, but then also training, exercising before the disaster happened with our local and state partners. And that's why we could successfully work with the states to evacuate 2.6 million people in Hurricane Floyd.
Jane Bullock, former FEMA Chief of Staff, now Risk Management Consultant, speaking to us from Washington. Jane, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the 60th session of the United Nations opens. Should this massive international body be reformed? And we'll also speak with novelist Julie Otsuka. Her book, When the Emperor Was Divine, about internment of Japanese Americans after World War II, has become a must-read in schools. Stay with us. Much more ahead Here and Now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR in Boston, where the program is produced in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, finding missing people, even missing pets. But the web also fell victim to the storm when service was disrupted. So why can't we keep the Internet running during a natural disaster? That's just one question for the people involved in a new effort being launched by the National Science Foundation this fall. The idea is really a simple one. Gather some of the best minds in the country and ask the question, if you could redesign the Internet from scratch, what would you do? David Clark is a researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He's working on the project. And Dr. Clark, besides keeping the Internet running during a natural disaster such as a hurricane, one of my first thoughts, if I want to build a better net, get rid of the spam. What's yours?
Well, my very first thought was security. It's just like yours. I think we should reconceive a network which is fundamentally more secure, which has got a what you might call an architecture for security, where everybody knows what their part of the job is. I'm worried about spam. There are even more pernicious things going on in the net. I don't know whether you've had this zombie story where people are taking over hundreds of thousands of computers and then causing them to all turn around and attack somebody.
Verbally?
No. They say, leave $10,000 on a street corner or I will flood your machine and take you off the net.
Right.
And they're doing it.
Right.
It's organized crime. It's extortion. We need to rethink that and see if we can come up with a framework in which things like that don't happen.
Well, you are thinking about that. So what do you think? How do you do that? Is it a technological problem or something else?
Well, you know, if you go back to the roots of the Internet, and we made some decisions back then, it's not that we made technical mistakes and we have to get them wrong. We got them wrong then. We have to get them right now. You mentioned spam. We could stop spam tomorrow, but it would cause some real social consequences that we probably don't want. For example, one of the design decisions in email is you don't have to prove who you are to send a piece of email, and I don't have to have your permission before I can send you a piece of email. Now, we could have said, no, you can't send email till you go to the post office and get the online equivalent of a permit, and then you have to attach your identity every time you send email. And that would have helped a lot, but it would have created some other social problems.
It wouldn't be the Internet.
It wouldn't be the open Internet. My son, who has moved beyond email and does instant messaging, runs his buddy list in what I might call a Victorian way. He won't talk to somebody unless he's been introduced.
Through email. Through
some
online,
third-party
right.
process.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get annoying messages on his instant messaging, but it's a very different cultural world. So it's really a rethinking of requirements in a socio-technical space.
Now, let's get right to that. Are you talking about legislation? Are you talking about building a computer that has these things in place that limit, for instance, spam?
It's not legislation, although legislation's a part of it. But, of course, spam is multinational, so that makes the recourse to law a little tricky. The Internet's defined by a set of fundamental design principles. I tend to call them the architecture of the Internet. And what I'm talking about is rethinking those design rules, and that would eventually be incorporated in new software in your computer and new software in the equipment that makes up the Internet. And, yeah, it might be complemented by laws and social norms and things like that.
Yeah. What are some of the other concerns that you're hearing?
The Internet's hard to use. It's easy to use when it works. It's terrible when it doesn't work. How many people have had the experience of bringing home this little box that's got a home network thingy in it, and you plug it all together, and it doesn't work? You say, well, what am I supposed to do now? We didn't design the Internet so that it was easy to manage. We were focused on getting the bits through. And the Internet carries bits real well. But when it doesn't work, it's terrible.
Well, David, that brings to mind for you who are thinking of building a better net. Might you invite someone who, speaks understandable English to be part of the process? I mean, somebody, you know, writers, people who are not technologically oriented who might help interpret.
Absolutely. That's got to be a part of the process. The geeks should not design the next generation of the Internet. This comment I had about security, this is a social question, and it requires commentary from tech-savvy social scientists and humanists and, what can I say, ordinary people. Mm. You're absolutely right. This is not a space. The Internet's not made out of routers. The Internet's made out of people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can't look at anything in this moment in time without looking through the prism of Hurricane Katrina. And we saw how the Internet was used by, well, people are looking for loved ones through Craigslist, and they're blogging where, you know, radio stations have gone down, you know, in the area. But on the other hand, we've come to rely on computers and the Internet, and the Internet went down in that area. I mean, you know, you couldn't have access. So your thoughts on how that might be improved?
So that's a wonderful example of what the NSF is trying to do, which is conceive of a different future and look 15 years out and then say, how could we get there? So we could declare that we had an objective that the next generation of the Internet would stay up when the power went down. It's not unrealistic.
What else are you all thinking about?
You know, computing's going to look very different in 10 years. Mm-hmm. Computers won't look like PCs and laptops and PDAs. I suspect in 10 years, most of the computers that you will be around you won't even see. They'll be embedded in your car, your shoes.
Ray Kurzweil says, in your head.
In your head. Well, we could go there. That's even worse or more exciting, depending on how you think about it. How are we going to network all those things together? If the average computer costs $1, then the average network connection has to cost 10 cents, right? So So I think the change in computing, the move to sensors and the embedded everywhere computing is a major technical driver of a next generation of network.
You mentioned that your main concern was security. Somehow rebuilding the Internet so that spam isn't an accepted part of it, viruses aren't accepted part of it, zombies aren't accepted part of it. But that gets back to, you know, there's criticism of that from, the diehard people who love the Internet because they say that is the natural side effect of the freewheeling spirit of it and that, you know, what part of the fun of being on the Internet is something can pop up and you can't stop it.
And I'm a deep fan of that. I'm actually a very deep fan of that. And that's why I'm saying what we need to think about is a complex balance in a social space. But let me tell you a story and see if you buy this story. Imagine that 10 years from now when you buy your computer, it's capable of being several computers at the same time. It's one piece of physical computing, but it's capable of being several virtual computers at the same time. And one of them, sort of your clean machine, is where you do stuff that really matters to you. It's mm-hmm. where you keep your checks and you keep your photographs because you don't want them lost. And it's where you pay your taxes and so forth. But then you can also, you know, flip a little switch on your computer and it turns into your anything goes computer. And you can run any kind of stuff there you want. You can go all sorts of weird places and download all sorts of weird software. But you set it up so that if that world gets too messy, you just sort of reset it because there's nothing there that really matters. That's not where your checks and your photographs are, so they can't get corrupted.
Huh.
So maybe I could sort of partition your experience and I could give you both of them.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know whether that works, but that's the kind of idea that might preserve all these values.
And the kind of thinking that you're
That's the kind
doing.
Of thinking that's on the table now, yeah.
David Clark, a researcher at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, also part of the National Science Foundation's project, an effort to re-engineer the Internet to build a better net. David, thanks for speaking with us.
Delighted to be here.
For one thing, they could build a better mouse. As always, we welcome your thoughts on the Internet, on anything on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Well, still to come, a new CD of the late, great pianist Bill Evans takes our jazz critic down memory lane. You're listening to Here and Now. When the UN opens session tomorrow, many in Taiwan are hoping their country's call for official recognition will be on the agenda. Taiwan split from mainland China in 1949 after a civil war, but China considers the 23 million people who live there part of its territory. Andrew Shaw is Director General of Taiwan's Economic and Culture Office in New York. Mr. Shaw, remind us, what is the political status of your country?
Well, thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure being here.
And how would you characterize the political status of your country?
Well, we are a sovereign, independent country ever since established in 1912. In 1949, we moved to Taiwan, and being a democracy, we have a directly elected president. As you say, the economy is thriving, and we are a full-fledged democracy, independent country.
Well, and you know, some would say, yes, Taiwan has there's been much democratic reform in Taiwan, thriving economy. Why is it so important for you to be in the UN? Everything seems to be going well.
Well, I think for other countries, it's almost as a matter of course that you join international organizations such as the UN. But for us, we have to explain why. Oh, let me tell you why. Mm. I think without participation or membership in the UN, we have difficulties as government, as people, as NGOs, leading a normal international life. And also, we have difficulties making contributions to the international community. Well, I'll give you one example, the latest, the tsunami relief. My government committed $50 million to help the victims there. But since this is a UN-organized relief work, our contribution was declined. Hmm. That's just one typical example. I mean, in the past, we also tried to help UNICEF. We tried during the Kosovo crisis, but all our contributions were declined.
I wonder, too, here you are looking for membership in the UN. China has membership in the UN. I'm mm-hmm. wondering if part of the reason you want membership in the UN is for protection from China. You know, is Taiwan afraid of China?
We're not afraid of China. We don't want to have any conflict with China. We basically tell the UN that there's a problem of the non-representation of 23 million people, larger than two-thirds of UN memberships. So the UN should consider this issue. But for 12 years, our request could not even reach the agenda. But this year, we also asked the UN to play a role in facilitating a dialogue between the two sides of Taiwan Strait, in urging the two sides to solve its dispute through peaceful means. As you know, we face 700 missiles aiming at us every single day. So we want the UN to play up its role in maintaining international peace and security.
Well, I guess, do you worry about antagonizing China, given those missiles that are facing you, by making this push for the UN?
Well, I think this is something we have to do. I mean, we make a political statement there. What happened between Taiwan and China in future, we don't know at this moment. The only thing we know is we are not part of the People's Republic of China at this moment. We are a sovereign, independent country entitled to whatever we want with international organizations.
And, of course, as we've said, China does not see it that way. And I'm wondering, the U.S. has long been a good friend of Taiwan, close trade
Indeed.
Relations. But are you worried about the increasingly close relations between the U.S. and China, especially when it comes to trade?
This is a globalized society. I mean, we live in this age that every country has to trade with each other. We trade with China as well. You know, we have about $100 billion investment in China. We have about a million people from Taiwan living, traveling, doing businesses in China. But we still wanted to point out that even with all these exchanges, we face a threat from China because of this military buildup, because of the anti-secession law enacted in March. It is true that the U.S. is our best friend, but we don't think that by doing business with China, the U.S. will forget about Taiwan. The U.S. has a historical and legal obligation, I mean, to protect Taiwan.
And one last question, Mr. Shaw. Some might wonder, why would Taiwan want so badly to join the U.N., given there's been so much criticism of the organization and so much controversy?
Well, I think the bottom line is, it is for us to decide whether we want to join or not to join. It's not just one country, a member of the Permanent Five, say that we couldn't join, so the rest of the world will deny us membership. We want to join, that this is the will of the people, and as civil servants, you know, we have to try to implement that.
Andrew Shaw is Director General of the Taipei Economic and Culture Office, speaking to us from New York City. Mr. Shaw, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin. It's a pleasure.
been 25 years since the death of jazz pianist Bill Evans, but his music lives on in a new 3-CD set called Bill Evans, The Complete Village Vanguard Recordings, 1961. And those CDs also bring deep memories for Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs, who has this reflection.
The name of this song is My Foolish Heart, and no one played it with greater depth of feeling than Bill Evans. It was the title tune for a 1949 movie from a short story called Uncle Wiggily in Connecticut by J.D. Salinger. Salinger was so appalled by the way Hollywood turned poor Uncle Wiggily into a tearjerker, he never again permitted anyone to adapt his work to the screen. I know this because early in 1963, after devouring The Catcher in the Rye, I read as much about its author as I could get my hands on. So when I found myself in New York on an autumn Sunday, easing into a nice and depressed Holden Caulfieldish mood, it didn't much matter that it was one of those heartbreakingly lovely Indian summer days. I hated just about everything the world had to offer a 15-year-old boy. The late afternoon sun headed westward toward the Hudson before dipping behind the Palisades. Too soon it would be winter, which I hated. I had traveled by commuter train to the city from Hartsdale, a Westchester suburb 22 miles to the north that no one would ever call posh. As was almost always the case when I was away from school, I kept to myself. These were my early days as a buck private in the army of Holden Caulfield Moncaze in New York, east side, west side, all around the town. Who knows how many Holdens had been around since the watershed summer of 1951, when The Catcher in the Rye perfectly caught the tone, the rhythms, and the dissonant melodies of a new kind of blues in the key of A minor, anguished, adolescent. I could never go so far as to don a red hunting hat a la Holden, but I could smoke unfiltered cigarettes, because on Salinger's pages, everyone smoked. I could also sneak a drink whenever possible and affect a studied skulk on the streets of Greenwich Village. I won't bore you with my extensive litany of loathing, which included everything from plain geometry to the early Bob Dylan. I hated that I could never really be Holden Caulfield because, A, I didn't go to prep school, and B, ever hear of a Jewish kid named Holden Caulfield? And another thing I hated, I didn't have attitude, even if I was attracted to jazz and foreign films, so I just shut up, sleepwalked through the 10th grade, and smoked. Oh, and one last thing. I hated most of all that my beloved paternal grandfather had died. Even in an open casket, Gramp was, to the end, a glass of fashion in his immaculately tailored steel-gray three-piece suit. Never again would he tell me slightly off-color jokes, talk with me about the city's new baseball team of lovable bumblers, the Mets, or quiz me in French while speaking that most romantic of languages in his cigar-smoky New York rasp. A year earlier, in the fall of 62, not long after Gramp left this world, Jazz and I found one another. And a few months later, I discovered I had a certain aptitude for playing the drums. It was because drummer Chico Hamilton's quartet was headlining at the Village Vanguard that I decided to descend the stairs at 178 7th Avenue South between 11th Street and Waverly Place. This was the first time I'd set foot in a nightclub. Admission for the matinee was $3, if memory serves, and the Bill Evans Trio was the opening act. When my parents were dating in the early 1940s, they'd gone to the Vanguard to see Betty Comden, Adolph Green, who a decade earlier had been my father's camp counselor, and Judy Holliday performing with the Reviewers. Now, nearly a quarter century later, here I was in the same triangular basement when Bill Evans materialized, specter-like. He was about 6'1", gaunt and pigeon-toed. I knew from the Encyclopedia of Jazz that Evans was 34 years old. He was wearing sunglasses, and his dark suit was frayed at the cuffs. His face was sallow, his brown hair slicked straight back. I was sitting about 5 feet from him. He sat down at the piano. Soon his frame was hunched into a reverse question mark, his nose barely above the puffy backs of his hands. Then he began to play. I didn't recognize the melody he started, but slowly I fell into what seemed like an opium dream. trio, and on that day Gary Peacock and Paul Modian were a sublimely empathic bass drums team, moved as one in an ever-shifting rhythmic flow, seldom stating directly the 4-4 or 3-4 time. Modian's brushes on his riveted ride cymbal laid down a carpet of stars on which piano and bass slow danced. Evan's gauzy chordal voicings lingered like twilight. They played a set of almost all ballads, ranging from melancholy to funereal. The audience was worshipfully silent, and the introverted pianist barely acknowledged their applause with a shy nod of his head at the end of each tune. After about 45 minutes, it was over, and he was gone from the bandstand. It was the most intensely romantic music I had ever heard, like the first time you saw a girl who was so beautiful. How could I go back to high school? Of course, the next morning, very early, I was at the bus stop. J.D. Salinger left New York a half century ago. Now 86, he lives in the hills of New Hampshire, a famous recluse. He's not published even a syllable for public consumption since 1965, and I, for one, am glad he stepped off the literary merry-go-round. It has been speculated that he writes only to please himself. Holden Caulfield would be in his early 70s. He was last seen in New York watching with insane joy as his little sister Phoebe rode round and round on the Central Park carousel. Bill Evans' body gave out on September 15, 1980, in New York. He was 51. As with my grandfather, when Evans died, he took a small part of me with him. On many nights, his poetic piano sang from the heart. How often really do such things happen, especially in this era of irony overdose? And how many people can say that for 45 transcendent minutes, they made a kid who hated nearly everything in his tiny world feel as if he wanted to live forever, right there at the Village Vanguard?
Here and now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs with memories of Bill Evans, who died 25 years ago, memories as well of his grandfather Mortimer Isaacs, who passed in 1962. The new 3-CD release, Bill Evans, The Complete Village Vanguard Recordings 1961, is just out. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.